For a moment, the king now remembered the face of that man, Aerith Akbi, as he stood on the beach of Salador, dark-eyed, sorrowful, mortally wounded, among the bones of the dragon who had killed him. But Bannon felt it strange that he should think of such faraway things at such a moment. And yet it was not strange, for the living and the dead, men and dragons, all were drawing together to some event could not see. He paused until Irion and Tahanu came up to him. As he walked on into the palace with them, he said, "Lady Irion, there are many things I would ask you, but what my people fear, and what the council will desire to know, is whether your people intend to make war on us, and why." He nodded a heavy, decisive nod. "I will tell them what I know." When they came to the curtained doorway behind the dais, the throne room was all in confusion, an uproar of voices, so that the crash of Prince Sege's staff was barely heard at first. Then silence came suddenly on them, and they all turned to see the king come in with the dragon. The Bannon did not sit but stood before the throne, and Irion stood to his left. "Hear the king," Sege said into that dead silence. The king said, "Counselors, this is a day that will long be told and sung. Your sons' daughters and your daughters' sons will say, 'I am the grandchild of one who was of the Dragon Council. So honor her whose presence honors us.' Hear, Orm Irion. Some of those who were at the Dragon Council said afterwards that if they looked straight at her, she seemed only a tall woman standing there. But if they looked aside, what they saw in the corner of their eye was a vast shimmer of smoky gold that dwarfed king and throne. And many of them, knowing a man must not look into a dragon's eye, did look aside, but they stole glimpses, too. The women looked at her, some thinking her plain, some beautiful, some pitying her for having to go barefoot in the palace. And a few counselors, not having rightly understood, wondered who the woman was and when the dragon would be coming."
All the time she spoke, that complete silence endured. Though her voice had the lightness of most women's voices, it filled the high hall easily. She spoke slowly and formally, as if she were translating in her mind from the older speech. "My name was Irion, of the domain of Old Iria on Way. I am Orm Irion now. Kalesan, the eldest, calls me daughter. I am sister to Orm Embar, whom the king knew, and grandchild of Orm, who killed the king's companion Aerith Akbi, and was killed by him. I am here because my sister Tehanu called to me. When Orm Embar died on Celador, destroying the mortal body of the wizard Cobb, Kalesan came from beyond the west and brought the king and the great mage to Roke. Then, returning to the Dragon's Run, the eldest called the people of the west, whose speech had been taken from them by Cobb, and who were still bewildered. Kalesan said to them, 'You let evil turn you into evil. You have been mad. You are sane again, but so long as the winds blow from the east, you can never be what you were, free of both good and evil.' Kalesan said, 'Long ago we chose. We chose freedom. Men chose the yoke. We chose fire and the wind. They chose water and the earth. We chose the west, and they the east.' And Kalesan said, 'But always among us, some envy them their wealth, and always among them, some envy us our liberty. So it was that evil came into us, and will come into us again, until we choose again, and forever, to be free. Soon I am going beyond the west to fly on the other wind, I will lead you there, or wait for you, if you will come. Then some of the dragons said to Kalesin, Men in their envy of us long ago stole half our realm beyond the west from us, and made walls of spells to keep us out of it. So now let us drive them into the farthest east, and take back the islands. Men and dragons cannot share the wind. Then Kalesin said, Once we were one people, and in sign of that, in every generation of men, one or two are born who are dragons also. And in every generation of our people, longer than the quick lives of men, one of us is born who is also human. Of these, one is now living in the Inner Isles. And there is one of them living there now, who is a dragon. These two are the messengers, the bringers of choice. There will be no more such born to us or to them, for the balance changes. And Kalesin said to them, Choose. Come with me to fly on the far side of the world on the other wind, or stay and put on the yoke of good and evil, or dwindle into dumb beasts. And at the last, Kalesin said, The last to make the choice will be Tehanu. After her there will be no choosing. There will be no way west. Only the forest will be, as it is always, at the center. The people in the king's council were still as stones, listening. Irian stood moveless, gazing as if through them, as she spoke. After some years had passed, Kalesin flew beyond the west. Some followed, some did not. When I came to join my people, I followed Kalesin, but I go there and come back, so long as the winds will bear me. The disposition of my people is jealous and irate. Those who stayed here on the winds of the world began to fly in bands or singly to the isles of men, saying again, They stole half our realm. Now we will take all the west of their realm and drive them out of it, so they cannot bring their good and evil to us any more. We will not put our necks into their yoke. But they did not try to kill the islanders, because they remembered being mad when dragon killed dragon. They hate you, but they will not kill you unless you try to kill them. So one of these bands has come now to this island, Havnar, that we call the Cold Hill. The dragon who came before them and spoke to Tehanu is my brother Ahmad. They seek to drive you into the east, but Ahmad, like me, enacts the will of Kalesin, seeking to free my people from the yoke you wear. If he and I and the children of Kalesin can prevent harm to your people and ours, we will do so. But dragons have no king, and obey no one, and will fly where they will. For a while they will do as my brother and I ask in Kalesin's name, but not for long. And they fear nothing in the world except your wizardries of death. That last word rang heavily in the great hall in the silence that followed Irian's voice. The king spoke, thanking Irian. He said, You honor us with your truth-speaking. By my name we will speak truth to you. I beg you to tell me, daughter of Kalesin, who bore me to my kingdom, what it is you say the dragons fear. I thought they feared nothing in the world or out of it. We fear your spells of immortality, she said bluntly. Of immortality? Labanan hesitated. I'm no wizard. Master Onyx, speak for me, if the daughter of Kalesin will permit. Onyx stood up. Irian looked at him with cold, impartial eyes and nodded. Lady Irian, the wizard said, we make no spells of immortality. Only the wizard Cobb sought to make himself immortal, perverting our art to do so. He spoke slowly and with evident care, searching his mind as he spoke. our archmage, with my lord the king, and with the aid of Orm Embar, destroyed Cobb and the evil he had done. And the archmage gave all his power up to heal the world, restoring the equilibrium. No other wizard in our lifetime has sought to... He stopped short. Irian looked straight at him. He looked down. The wizard I destroyed, she said, the summoner of Roke, Thorian. What was it he sought? Onyx, stricken, said nothing. He came back from death, she said, but not living, as the archmage and the king did. He was dead, but he came back across the wall by his arts, by your arts, you men of Roke. How are we to trust anything you say? You have unmade the balance of the world. Can you restore it? Onyx looked at the king. He was openly distressed. My lord, I cannot think that this is the place to discuss such matters before all men until we know what we are talking about and what we must do. Roke keeps its secrets, Irian said with calm scorn. But on Roke, Tehanu said, not standing. Her weak voice died away. Prince Sege and the king both looked at her and motioned her to speak. She stood up. At first she kept the left side of her face to the counselors, all sitting motionless on their benches, like stones with eyes. On Roke is the imminent grove, she said. Isn't that what Kalesin meant, sister? Speaking of the forest that is at the center. Turning to Irian, she showed the people watching her the whole ruin of her face, but she had forgotten them. Maybe we need to go there, she said, to the center of things. Irian smiled. I'll go there, she said. They both looked at the king. Before I send you to Roke, or go with you, he said slowly, I must know what is at stake. Master Onyx, I'm sorry that matters so grave and chancy force us to debate our course so openly, but I trust my counselors to support me as I find and hold the course. What the council needs to know is that our islands need not fear attack from the people of the West, that the truce, at least, holds. It holds, Irian said. Can you say how long? A half year, she offered carelessly, as if she had said a day or two. We will hold the truce a half year, in hope of peace to follow. Am I right to say, Lady Irian, that to have peace with us, your people want to know that our wizards meddling with the laws of life and death will not endanger them? Endanger all of us, Irian said. Yes.
Labanon considered this, and then said in his most royal, affable, urbane manner, Then I believe I should come to Roke with you. He turned to the benches. Counselors, with the truce declared, we must seek the peace. I'll go wherever I must go on that quest, ruling as I do in the sign of Elfarin's ring. If you see any hindrance to this journey, speak here and now. For it may be that the balance of power within the archipelago, as well as the equilibrium of the whole, is in question. And if I go, I must go now. Autumn is near, and it's not a short voyage to Roke Island. The stones with eyes sat there for a long minute, all staring, none speaking. Then Prince Sege said, Go, my lord king, go with our hope and trust and the mage wind in your sails. There was a little murmur of assent from the counselors. Yes, yes, hear him. Sege asked for further questions or debate. Nobody spoke. He closed the session. Leaving the throne room with him, Labanon said, "Thank you, Senge." And the old prince said, "Between you and the dragon, Labanon, what could the poor souls say?"
Chapter 4 Dolphin.
Many matters had to be settled and arrangements made before the king could leave his capital. There was also the question of who would go with him to Roke. Irian and Tahanu, of course. And Tahanu wanted her mother with her. Onyx said that Alder should by all means go with them. And also the Pelnish wizard Seppel, for the lore of Paln had much to do with these matters of crossing between life and death. The king chose Tosla to captain the dolphin as he had done before. Prince Sergei would look after affairs of state in the king's absence with a selected group of counselors, as he also had done before. So it was all settled, or so Labanon thought, until Tanar came to him 2 days before they were to sail and said, "You'll be talking of war and peace with the dragons, and of matters even beyond that," Irian says. "Matters that concern the balance of all things in Earthsea. The people of the Kargad lands should hear these discussions and have a voice in them. You will be their representative." "Well, not I. I am not a subject of the High King. The only person here who can represent his people is his daughter." Labanon took a step away from her, turned partly from her, and at last said in a voice stifled by the effort to speak without anger, "You know that she is completely unfitted for such a journey." "I know nothing of the kind." "She has no education. She's intelligent, practical, and courageous. She's aware of what her station requires of her. She hasn't been trained to rule, but then what can she learn boxed up there in the river house with her servants and some court ladies? To speak the language in the first place. She's doing that. I'll interpret for her when she needs it." After a brief pause, Labanon spoke carefully. "I understand your concern for her people. I will consider what can be done. But the princess has no place on this voyage. Tehanu and Irian both say she should come with us. Master Onyx says that, like Alder of Taun, her being sent here at this time cannot be an accident." Labanon walked farther away. His tone remained stiffly patient and polite. "I cannot permit it. Her ignorance and inexperience would make her a serious burden, and I can't put her at risk. Relationships with her father, in her ignorance, as you call it, she showed us how to answer Ged's questions. You are as disrespectful of her as her father is. You speak of her as of a mindless thing." Dinar's face was pale with anger. "If you're afraid to put her at risk, ask her to take it herself." Again there was a silence. Labanon spoke with the same wooden calmness, not looking directly at her. "If you and Tahanu and Orm Irian believe this woman should come with us to Roke and Onyx agrees with you, I accept your judgment, though I believe it is mistaken. Please tell her that if she wishes to come, she may do so." "It is you who should tell her that." He stood silent. Then he walked out of the room without a word. He passed close by Tanar, and though he did not look at her, he saw her clearly. She looked old and strained, and her hands trembled. He was sorry for her, ashamed of his rudeness to her, relieved that no one else had witnessed the scene, but these feelings were mere sparks in the huge darkness of his anger at her, at the princess, at everyone and everything that laid this false obligation, this grotesque duty on him. As he went out of the room, he tugged open the collar of his shirt as if it were choking him. His major domo, a slow and steady man called Thorogood, was not expecting him to return so soon, or through that door, and jumped up, staring and startled. Labanon returned his stare icily and said, "Send for the High Princess to attend me here in the afternoon." "The High Princess? Is there more than one of them? Are you unaware that the High King's daughter is our guest? Amazed, Thorogood stammered an apology, which Labanon interrupted. I shall go to the river house myself. And he strode on out, pursued, impeded, and gradually controlled by the majordomo's attempts to slow him down long enough for a suitable retinue to be gathered, horses to be brought from the stables, the petitioners waiting for audience in the long room to be put off till afternoon, and so on. All his obligations, all his duties, all the trappery and trammel, rites and hypocrisies that made him king, pulled at him, sucking and tugging him down like quicksand into suffocation. When his horse was brought across the stable yard to him, he swung up into the saddle so abruptly that the horse caught his mood and backed and reared, driving back the hostlers in attendance. To see the circle widen out around him gave Labanon a harsh satisfaction. He set the horse straight for the gateway without waiting for the men in his retinue to mount. He led them at a sharp trot through the streets of the city, far ahead of them, aware of the dilemma of the young officer who was supposed to precede him, calling, "Way for the king!" but who had been left behind him and now did not dare ride past him. It was near noon. The streets and squares of Havnor were hot and bright and mostly deserted. Hearing the clatter of hooves, people hurried to the doorways of little dark shops to stare and recognize and salute the king. Women sitting in their windows, fanning themselves and gossiping across the way, looked down and waved, and one of them threw a flower down at him. His horse's hooves rang on the bricks of a broad, sun-baked square that lay empty except for a curly-tailed dog trotting away on three legs, unconcerned with royalty. Out of the square, the king took a narrow passage that led to the paved way beside the Saranen, and followed it in the shadow of the willows under the old city wall to River House. The ride had changed his temper somewhat. The heat and silence and beauty of the city, the sense of multitudinous life behind walls and shutters, the smile of the woman who had tossed a flower, the petty satisfaction of keeping ahead of all his guardians and pomp-makers, then finally the scent and coolness of the river ride and the shady courtyard of the house where he had known days and nights of peace and pleasure, all took him a little distance from his anger. He felt estranged from himself, no longer possessed, but emptied. The first riders of his retinue were just coming into the courtyard as he swung off his horse, which was glad to stand in the shade. He went into the house, dropping among dozing footmen like a stone into a glassy pond, causing quick widening circles of dismay and panic. He said, "Tell the princess that I am here." Lady Opal of the old domain of Ilion, currently in charge of the princess's ladies-in-waiting, appeared promptly, greeted him graciously, offered him refreshment, behaved quite as if his visit were no surprise at all. This suavity half-placated, half-irritated him. Endless hypocrisy. But what was Lady Opal to do? Gawp like a stranded fish, as a very young lady-in-waiting was doing? Because the king had finally and unexpectedly come to see the princess? "I'm so sorry Mistress Tanar isn't here at present," she said. "It's so much easier to converse with the princess with her help, but the princess is making admirable progress in the language." Labanon had forgotten the problem of language. He accepted the cool drink offered him and said nothing. Lady Opal made small talk with the assistance of the other ladies, getting very little from the king. He had begun to realize that he would probably be expected to speak with the princess in the company of all her ladies, as was only proper. Whatever he had intended to say to her, it had become impossible to say anything. He was just about to get up and excuse himself when a woman whose head and shoulders were hidden by a red circular veil appeared in the doorway, fell plop on her knees, and said, "Please? King? Princess? Please?" "The princess will receive you in her chambers, sire," Lady Opal interrupted. She waved to a footman who escorted him upstairs along a hall, through an anteroom, through a large dark room that seemed to be crammed absolutely full of women in red veils, and out onto a balcony over the river. There stood the figure he remembered. The immobile cylinder of red and gold. The breeze from the water made the veils tremble and shimmer, so that the figure did not appear solid, but delicate, moving, shivering, like the willow foliage. It seemed to shrink, to shorten. He was making her courtesy to him. He bowed to her. They both straightened up and stood in silence. "Princess," LeBenin said with a feeling of unreality hearing his own voice, "I am here to ask you to come with us to Roke Island." She said nothing. He saw the fine red veils part in an oval as she spread them with her hands. Long-fingered, golden-skinned hands held apart to reveal her face in the red shadow. He could not see her features clearly. She was nearly as tall as he, and her eyes looked straight at him. "My friend Tanar," she said, "say, king to see king, face and face." "I say, yes, I will." Half understanding, LeBanon bowed again. "You honor me, my lady?"
"Yes,"
she said. "I honor you." He hesitated. This was a different ground entirely. Her ground. She stood there, straight and still, the gold edging of her veils shivering, her eyes looking at him out of the shadow. Tanar and Tehanu and Ormirian agreed that it would be well if the princess of the Kargad lands were with us on Roke Island, so I ask you to come with us.
To come.
To Roke Island.
On ship,
she said, and suddenly made a little moaning, plaintive noise. Then she said,
"I will. I will to come."
He did not know what to say. He said, "Thank you, my lady." She nodded once, equal to equal. He bowed. He left her as he had been taught to leave the presence of his father, the prince, at formal occasions in the port of Inlad, not turning his back but stepping backwards. She stood facing him, still holding her veil parted till he reached the doorway. Then she dropped her hands. The veils closed, and he heard her gasp and breathe out hard, as if in release from an act of will sustained almost past endurance. Courageous, Tanar had called her. He did not understand, but he knew that he had been in the presence of courage. All the anger that had filled him, brought him here, was gone, vanished. He had not been sucked down and suffocated, but brought up short in front of a rock, a high place in clear air, a truth. He went out through the room full of murmuring, perfumed, veiled women who shrank back from him into the darkness. Downstairs, he chatted a little with Lady Opal and the others and had a kind word for the gawping 12-year-old lady-in-waiting. He spoke pleasantly to the men of his retinue waiting for him in the courtyard. He quietly mounted his tall gray horse. He rode quietly, thoughtfully, back to the palace of Meharian.
Balder heard with fatalistic acceptance that he was to sail back to Roke. His waking life had become so strange to him, more dreamlike than his dreams, that he had little will to question or protest. If he was fated to sail from island to island the rest of his life, so be it. He knew there was no such thing as going home for him now. At least he would be in the company of the ladies Tanar and Tehanu, who put his heart at ease. And the wizard Onyx had also shown him kindness. Alder was a shy man, and Onyx a deeply reserved one, and there was all the difference of their knowledge and status to be bridged. But Onyx had come to him several times, simply to talk as one man of the art to another, showing a respect for Alder's opinion that puzzled his modesty. But Alder could not withhold his trust. And so when the time to depart was near at hand, he took to Onyx the question that had been worrying him. "It's the little cat," he said with embarrassment. "I don't feel right about taking him. Keeping him cooped up so long, it's unnatural for a young creature. And I think, what would become of him?" Onyx did not ask what he meant. He asked only, "He still helps you keep from the wall of stones?" "Well, often he does." Onyx pondered. "You need some protection till we get to Roke. I have thought... Have you spoken with the wizard Seppel here?" "The man from Palm," Alder said, with a slight unease in his voice. Palm, the greatest island west of Havnor, had the reputation of being an uncanny place. The Pelnish spoke Hardic with a peculiar accent, using many words of their own. Their lords had, in ancient times, refused fealty to the kings of Enlad and Havnor. Their wizards did not go to Roke for their training. The Pelnish lore, which called upon the old powers of the earth, was widely believed to be dangerous, if not sinister. Long ago, the Grey Mage of Palm had brought ruin on his island by summoning the souls of the dead to advise him and his lords, and that tale was part of the education of every sorcerer. The living should not take counsel of the dead. There had been more than one duel in wizardry between a man of Roke and a man of Palm. In one such combat 2 centuries ago, a plague had been loosed on the people of Palm and Semmel that had left half the towns and farmlands desolate. And 15 years ago, when the wizard Cobb had used the Pelnish lore to cross between life and death, the Archmage Sparrowhawk had spent all his own power to defeat him and heal the evil he had done. Alder, like almost everyone else at court and in the King's Council, had politely avoided the wizard Seppel. "I've asked the King to bring him with us to Roke," said Onyx. Alder blinked. "They know more than we do about these matters," Onyx said. "Most of our art of summoning comes from the Pelnish lore. Thorion was a master of it. The summoner of Roke now, Brand of Venway, won't use any part of his craft that draws from that lore. Misused, it has brought only harm. But it may be only our ignorance that's led us to use it wrongly. It goes back to very ancient times. There may be knowledge in it we've lost. Seppel is a wise man and mage. I think he should be with us, and I think he might help you, if you can trust him." "If he has your trust," Alder said, "he has mine." When Alder spoke with the silver tongue of town, Onyx was likely to smile a little dryly. "Your judgment's as good as mine, Alder, in this business," he said. "Or better. I hope you use it. But I'll take you to him." So they went down into the city together. Seppel's lodging was in an old part of town near the shipyards, just off Boatwright Street. There was a little colony of Pelnish folk there, brought in to work in the king's yards, for they were great shipbuilders. The houses were ancient, crowded close, with the bridges between roof and roof that gave Havnor Great Port a second, airy web of streets high above its paved ones.